This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell. On today's show, a look at the complex issue of violence as an occupational hazard for journalists in Latin America. Why the latest plan to save the Murray-Darling River has been called laughable by the Wentworth Group of Scientists. And we'll hear how a community has responded to Dart Energy beginning construction on the company's first coal seam gas pilot production wells in the state. In Fullerton Cove, a 10-minute drive north of Newcastle, the rural hobby farming community has set up camp across a partially built road. They've been there since Monday. Dart Energy CEO Robert Wyer, at last year's New South Wales Standing Committee inquiry into coal seam gas, described CSG as a cleaner fossil fuel right here on our doorstep, which can provide cleaner energy with minimal environmental impact and allow other land uses to continue. However, Fullerton Cove residents are concerned about their water supply, the potential impact on the drinking supply for Newcastle, and the Ramsar-listed wetlands nearby. No environmental impact statement has been done, nor was required for Dart to receive the federal and state departmental approval to begin work on the site. This is something the residents at Fullerton Cove are hoping to change, and are taking the issue to the Land and Environment Court. Lindsay Clout is a Fullerton Cove local, and I spoke with him yesterday while he was at the blockade.
The Fullerton Cove area is a low wetlands floodplain area, perched between Stockton Beach and the Hunter River.
And how long has the community known about Dart Energy's plans for their CSG pilot production wells?
Probably approaching 10 months now.
And has there been exploration on the site?
Yes, there has been exploration. It's been on and off for quite a few years, just small levels of activity. And it was very difficult to find any information about the exploration. I mean, Dart Energy didn't carry out the exploration. I think that was, there are a couple of companies that have come and gone.
How close is the planned drilling site to where the Ramsar-listed wetlands are?
500 metres.
And you were concerned about the impact on the local water supply as well as for nearby Newcastle?
Yes, that's correct. The people of Fullerton Cove rely on the two aquifers, the 6-metre and the 30-metre aquifer, for our water supply. We don't have town water here. We rely on those aquifers for all our watering and stock water, and there are people that have access to the second aquifer, and they draw off pristine, clean water that they put straight into their water tanks for drinking. They will drill through both of those aquifers.
What are your main environmental concerns? You've mentioned the impact on the drinking water supply. Do you have others if this pilot does go ahead?
Well, it's all focused around the water supply. I mean, I've detailed how all of the residents use the water supply, but, that's the human inhabitants, but the whole ecosystem is dependent upon the high groundwater of this floodplain. And a major concern is that if the high groundwater is either contaminated with salt or contaminated with gas, or through depressurizing the coal seam to release gas, that the aquifer levels drop because of the pressure balance, it will change the whole ecosystem. If the land dries out, what is growing here at the moment will not survive. It relies on high levels of groundwater for its existence, so the vegetation will perish. If the vegetation perishes, obviously everything that is relying on that vegetation for its life will perish as well. I mean, it is a huge issue.
Are you prepared to follow the footsteps of other Lock the Gate blockades? Didn't residents on the Liverpool Plains hold their blockade for months?
Yes, that's what it takes. We would be happy to do that, because Dart have told us that they have a 50-day window to complete these works. So we'd be quite happy to extend those kinds of lengths, because we know that will completely stop the job for them. The Department of Trade and Investment put out a media release, and the comments in the middle of that media release I think, are hugely significant for our argument, and I'll just read them to you. They say the assessments that were carried out for this proposal, the assessments confirm that the proposed activity is unlikely to have an impact on groundwater and is unlikely to pose a risk to Newcastle's drinking water. The activity is not likely to impact on wetlands of national significance. I mean, that is just deplorable.
So what assessment has taken place if they haven't undertaken an environmental impact statement?
They have carried out a review of environmental factors, just an REF. That's probably the most minimal work that can be done when making an application like this.
That was local resident and president of the Fullerton Cove Action Group, Lindsay Clout, speaking about the blockade just north of Newcastle against Dart Energy beginning construction on their coal seam gas pilot production wells. Elaine Johnson is a solicitor with the New South Wales Environmental Defenders Office. She's acting on behalf of Fullerton Cove residents and taking the case to the New South Wales Land and Environment Court.
Basically, our client is of the view that the project is likely to have a significant impact on the environment, and therefore an environmental impact statement is required, and that full development application and consent is required under the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act through the usual DA process via the council, as opposed to what's happened in this case where an approval has been issued by the New South Wales Department of Trade and Investment.
Purely because of the concern of the residents?
That's correct. The reason why our client believes that a full environmental impact statement is required and is important is because that would then allow the project to be opened up to community consultation, and therefore the public would have an opportunity to comment on the impact of the project in the community as well as on the environment.
And also, how relevant to the case is it that Ramsar listed wetlands are nearby?
That's not specifically an issue that is concerning us in this case, because that is related to the federal government's decision to allow the project to go ahead. So our client's focused really on the New South Wales government decision in this case. Our client's primary concern is that the development is what is classified as designated development because of the fact that it's located on a floodplain in the area. So that's our client's primary concern. However, if the court decides that a full environmental impact statement is required, then that assessment would have to do a full environmental assessment of all issues related to the project.
And what would some of those broader issues be?
Those issues that you've mentioned, so in relation to impacts on water, community, social and economic impacts, so the full range of environmental and social impacts of the project.
That's Elaine Johnson, solicitor with the New South Wales Environmental Defenders Office, speaking there. She's representing Fullerton Cove residents who are challenging Dart Energy's CSD project in the Land and Environment Court. A group of scientists say the latest revision of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan has no chance of creating a healthy river system. A third version of the river plan was released earlier this month in an attempt to break the deadlock between state governments, irrigators and conservationists. But the Wentworth group of concerned scientists say the plan would not pass a science test, a fairness test, a governance test. It would not even pass the laugh test. Third Degree Simon Unwin spoke to Tim Stubbs, an environmental engineer from the Wentworth group.
Basically, it all comes back to understanding how much water we need to put back into the river system so that it's a healthy river system. And by healthy, we don't mean sort of going back to pristine. What we mean is a river system that can function so that the water stays clean. We don't get things like algal blooms as regularly as we do if we're not getting enough water through the system. And we also flush out the salt that naturally accumulates in the river that leaches out of the landscape, because it's quite a salty landscape. So it's really about putting enough water back, or maybe a better way to put it is not taking as much water out, so that there's enough water flowing through the system to keep the river system in a healthy and functioning state, which will mean that we can use the water from the river in the long term, rather than running it down and using it like a drain and turning it into a mess, which, you know, won't have uses in the future.
Sure. So what are the kind of amounts proposed at the moment for irrigators and so on to be taking out of the river?
At the moment, the irrigators take out about 11,500 gigalitres from the river. So historically, before people started taking water from the river, on average you'd have about 12,000 gigalitres flowing out the mouth. Now, with the water that we take, we've reduced that significantly down to around 4,000 gigalitres. That sounds like a lot of water still flowing out the mouth, but it's not enough to let the river function. And these river systems travel from, you know, up in Queensland, right through New South Wales, Victoria, and down out at the mouth in South Australia. And they really work by having a process of drying out through the droughts, and then when the floods come, the big floods move out onto the floodplain because the landscape's very flat and the water spills from the channel and out onto the floodplain. But that actually picks up a lot of material that's been composting out on the floodplain through the dry period and brings that back to the river channel, and that feeds the ecosystems of the river channel. So that's how the river works. And if you don't have big enough flows to get that water out on the floodplain and water the trees and ecosystems of the floodplain, but also bring the material back into the river and take the salts out down to the mouth, then the system doesn't function.
And I suppose with the systems of agriculture and all of the dams that are in certain tributaries of the river system, those kinds of cycles of flood and drought aren't happening to the same extent that they were previously.
Definitely not. That's exactly right. So the dams have allowed us to catch the small and medium-sized floods. So the floodplain was used to getting watered every 2 to 5 years, say, and that was enough to flush the material down the system and get all those ecosystems functioning so the water stayed clean and we flushed out the salts. Now we catch those small and medium-sized floods with the dams and just trickle that water down in the river channel and take it out for irrigation. And the only floods we do see getting on the floodplain are the really big events, which happen every 10 to 15 years. Now, if you're a part of the ecosystem that was used to having these events that triggered your whole life cycle every 2 to 5 years, you're going to be in real trouble if it only happens every 10 to 15 years. And that's our problem. We definitely need irrigation in the basin. Don't get me wrong, irrigation is an important part of growing our food. But we need to make sure that we're leaving enough water in the system so that it can actually operate to support irrigation and anything else long into the future.
Yeah, so I guess the whole point of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan and you know, the establishment of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, who is working on the plan over a period of many years, is to work towards having a healthier river system.
Mm.
So the targets that they're sort of looking towards in this latest version of the plan, what's wrong with those?
Basically, they're about half or a little over half of what we need. So the minimum we need to get the system back to health is to return about 4,000 gigalitres to the river system. This plan proposes returning about 2,750. So, I mean, in the context, you might think, oh, that's a good start. And it would be a good start, except that the taxpayer, so everyone that pays taxes, is putting up $8.9 billion for this reform. That's $8.9 billion. Now, there's 16,000 irrigators in the Murray-Darling Basin. If you work that out on a per-irrigator basis, they get about $500,000 each. Now, it doesn't work out like that. Some people will get more, others might not get any, depending on if they want to sell their water back to the government or get infrastructure upgrades on their farm. But basically, we're a long way short of the mark. We're spending way over the odds to get there. Really, it would only cost about $6 billion if you bought the water on the market and fixed the whole thing up in one fell swoop. So we're paying way over the odds, getting about half the result. And another big concern is the system also has big aquifers, so areas of water that's gradually making its way through the underground towards the river system, making its way through the soil. Now, that water takes a lot longer to get from the land where it has fallen down and into the river system. And that's an important thing in the drought times, because when there's not rain falling and running down the river, the water flowing through the groundwater actually is what causes the flows of the river. So if you see a river flowing when it's not raining, that's because the groundwater is gradually making its way into the river. Now, the new plan increases the amount of groundwater people can take by over 1,600 gigalitres. So we've seen a massive increase in that water that actually feeds the system in the dry times, a less than optimal reduction, or less than the minimum reduction that we need for a healthy river system, and we're spending way over the odds of taxpayers' dollars.
Mm. So is that increase in groundwater extraction, is that meant to be compensating irrigators for the water that they'll no longer be able to take out of the river proper?
Well, no irrigator gives up water without selling it on the water market. So it's just like if you decide to sell your house, you get the going price for your house. The irrigator sells their water, gets the going price for that water. So they don't lose anything. They get paid to take in the to account the opportunity costs that they won't get if they don't have the water. So it's a fair and open process. So there's really no need to compensate or give someone back something. So it's very unclear why these big increases in groundwater extraction have come about. Some people have raised that it may be for coal seam gas, and some of it will definitely be earmarked for that, I'm sure. But, yeah, there's this grey area of how that will happen. Will that water be put onto a market and sold? That's not been done before. Or will the licences just be handed out? And, you know, in 10 years' time, when we realise that too much was given away out of the groundwater, which definitely there has been, will we have to run a whole program again of spending taxpayers' money to try to get the system back into balance?
From some of the other stories that we've been doing on CSG, there are projects, especially in Queensland, but also in New South Wales, where the allocations of groundwater given to those companies are more or less unlimited, and if not no cost, then very little cost, which is a worry because, you know, obviously, the public are still having to pay for the river, and irrigators are having to pay for the stuff that they take out of the river.
I think with coal seam gas, we've got to put it in a context as well of how does it compare to what we've already done to the landscapes. The Australian landscape has been, you know, done a pretty raw deal over the last 150 years, and we've caused a hell of a lot of damage to the function of the landscape. And we need to try to get back to some sort of equilibrium so the landscape can keep giving us the sort of benefits we gain from it. And coal seam gas is just another challenge on that landscape. So it's probably not going to be any worse or better than all the things we've done in the past, but we need to understand where the limits are to the capacity of the landscape and work out if we are going to introduce another use to the landscape, maybe we have to back off somewhere else.
I understand that there's a certain amount of conflict between various governments and groups on the form that this plan should take, and that's one of the reasons why it's having to be revised so many times. I mean, what are the main conflicts between, say, states further up the river compared to, say, South Australia?
Well, basically what you've got is Victoria and New South Wales in particular advocating for a lower number to go back to the river, and what you're sort of seeing in those states is a very powerful irrigation lobby is, you know, getting quite a bit of traction with the governments, and you know, the governments are advocating that we actually put less water back in the river. Now, those governments have got a lot of money through different infrastructure projects to upgrade irrigation infrastructure and all sorts of things. South Australia, on the other hand, that's at the end of the system, if you like, they get all the salts and whatever that come from higher up in the system, and I guess can see the loss and the lack of health of the Coorong and Lower Lakes and also the Chowler floodplain, a huge floodplain complex in South Australia. Now, these are internationally recognised wetlands of, you know, international importance, and the South Australian government is adamant that it wants to see the federal government comply with the Water Act, which is a national act, and deliver the amount of or the volumes of water required to get a healthy working river.
I was travelling down through those parts of New South Wales and Victoria earlier in the year, going down to Adelaide, and just travelling through those sort of irrigation towns that were very much these modernist projects of the 50s, the sort of post-war era. And it's really astonishing sort of the landscape either side of the river is, you could almost call it desert. And you have these sort of oases of irrigated land where you're growing oranges and so on. And, yeah, but just over the border you've got the wetlands, as you say, and the Coorong, and also, you know, Adelaide sort of struggling with where it's going to get its drinking water for the next 10 years. It's interesting to see these different communities kind of almost being pitted against each other in terms of the way that the river should be used.
Yeah, and that's a terrible outcome and a product of how this reform has been undertaken, and I think a bad reflection on the government that has implemented this reform, because with $8.9 billion, there was enough money to simply buy the water that was needed for a healthy river on the water market. No one's out of pocket if the water's bought on a market. People are concerned that when irrigators sell their water, they might move out of the regional community and go to the coast to retire or something like that. Recent study has shown that, you know, the large majority of money that's gone into buying back water has actually stayed within those regional communities. So people have either retired in the town or invested in other things or adjusted their farm. And, you know, if we spent $6 billion on buying the water, under $8.9 billion reform, you're still looking at $3 billion to actually get really proactive and say, how can we use these serious amounts of money to help these regional communities diversify and map out different futures? Because one bad thing we have seen is when there's a drought, clearly there's no water, not much water for irrigation, and those communities really suffer in those times. With a more diversified economic base, hopefully there'd be the potential for them to attract people and new industries and maybe be able to last the droughts a little better.
Tim Stubbs of the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists, speaking there to Third Degree's Simon Unwin. PEN International have launched a campaign against the violence faced by journalists and writers in Latin America. Called Right Against Impunity, PEN are hoping to spotlight the issue and counter the self-censorship many journalists are practicing for personal safety. I spoke with Carl Schirren, researcher and campaigner at PEN International on Latin American issues.
It's a literary protest. I mean, we're a global association of writers and journalists, and we do quite a lot of kind of traditional lobbying and advocacy in particular cases of writers and journalists who've been persecuted, murdered, or imprisoned around the world. But we also have a literary side, and this campaign brings together our kind of public advocacy with our literary interests in a kind of a written protest against the impunity that's currently the situation in Latin America.
And so you're calling for people to write on this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Our main focus is on writers in Latin America, but also members of the public in Latin America. Latin America is currently the most dangerous region in the world in which to be a writer or a journalist. It's in the first 6 months of 2012, it's killed more writers and journalists than any other region in the world. Mexico, for example, is the second most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. Honduras is the fifth, Brazil is the sixth. The rate of killings has increased rapidly over the last couple of years. All our members are writers, journalists, their friends and colleagues are writers and journalists. But we're asking everyone with roots in Latin America or friends in Latin America to write something.
And which country is Mexico second to?
Mexico second to Syria, obviously. It's interesting that Mexico's up there, even though Mexico isn't at war.
And why has the situation in Mexico become so much more dangerous for journalists since President Felipe Calderon began the country's war against drug trafficking in 2006?
Well, it's become more dangerous because, well, first of all, he brought the army in to deal with the cartels. And the problem with Mexico is that the corruption is endemic. Once open war was declared, the level of violence increased so much that there were no limits, and tit-for-tat violence between army, cartels fighting each other for control, cartels, and when there's more risk involved, they're more willing to take more extreme measures, the cartels, the army as well. And journalists getting caught in the crossfire, obviously merely reporting on organized crime in Mexico can get you killed. That's why so many journalists now have resorted to self-censorship, where they won't have their names, won't have bylines on their pieces. Lots of newspapers refuse to cover organized crime, refuse to cover local government corruption, because very often organized crime and local government corruption are the same thing. There's genuine fear amongst journalists because of this level of violence is growing. And there's serious concerns that the army, the navy and the police are heavily involved in what the cartels are doing and themselves are carrying out some of these killings of journalists and writers.
So a report by the Canadian branch of PEN released last year, focusing on what they call the war on Mexico's journalists, talks about the chill of the lack of information being reported about the ongoing violence from the drug trade in places such as Ciudad Juárez.
Mm-hmm.
This report also recommends the Mexican government introduce a similar protective mechanism that is used in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And this was a USAID initiative involving safety fit-outs for officers as well as radios and bulletproof vests for journalists.
Mm-hmm.
What difference do you think this has made in Colombia that might be able to be transferred to other parts of Latin America?
Well, it's a difficult one because in Mexico they have actually now introduced two protective mechanisms for journalists, and federal authorities can order these protective measures to be awarded to journalists at risk who say they've been threatened in some way. However, the problem is in Mexico, Mexico's obviously a collection of states, the problem is getting individual states to act in accordance with what the federal government orders. recently there was recently, in, I think in July, they the law or attacks on journalists were made federal crimes, and this is something that Pen International has been campaigning on for quite a while. It's a fantastic development. However, now everything depends upon the secondary legislation, i.e., what will the states do to enforce this law and carry out these laws effectively. It's the same for the protective measures. At the moment, we have to rely on individual states to award these measures. And there's a real problem of trust in Mexico at the moment. Journalists and writers just don't trust the government, don't trust local government. If I give you an example, in Veracruz, just a few months ago, there was what they call a death list circulating. And this had this was a list of journalists and writers to be murdered in the coming months in the city. When journalists went to local government to ask what they should do, local government said, you've got to get out of town. And that's it. So there wasn't even an attempt to provide corrective measures. It was just get out of town. Mexico's at the moment, it's a bit wilder and a little bit more out of control, I think.
And can you speak a little bit about the situation in Honduras?
Yeah, Honduras is, Honduras is the murder capital of the world. More people are killed there every year per 100,000 members of the population than anywhere else. Honduras is probably, in terms of impunity, it's probably worse than Mexico. It's probably the worst place in Latin America. Since the illegal coup of 2009, which split journalists not down the middle, but say 75-25, there's been a huge increase in violence against journalists. They now have a democratically elected government, although that the legitimacy is doubted by some observers. But if you're a journalist in Honduras and you want to investigate the crimes of the coup, you want to investigate the massive privatization projects that have been unrolled that are displacing ordinary citizens, you want to investigate attacks on community radio, you're going to come under threat. You're going to get shot at, or your radio station is going to get blown up. Your newspaper offices are going to get shot at. And there was even there was a murder on the 10th of August, Jose Noel Canales, and there's no notion of why he was killed. But at the same time, the authorities don't do much to investigate. There's a near 100% impunity rate there.
And has there been much of a response to the campaign so far?
Yeah, I've been quite impressed by the response to the campaign. We've got a lot of coverage on in Mexican newspapers, in a couple of Colombian newspapers. We're even getting talked about on community radio in Mexico. We've got a number of journalists and writers willing to contribute text already. So we're hoping to have an e-book available with all these texts in November, which is the kind of general month of impunity. And then we're hoping to produce a print anthology of these works.
That's Carl Sheeran, researcher and campaigner at Pen International, speaking with me about the new Right Against Impunity campaign. That's it for The Third Degree this week. I'm Jessica Mitchell, and this is 2SER.